leaders who allowed these conditions to exist. You have to understand that the militarization of the police occurred while we have the current black leaders and so-called black militants on watch. It's occurred. Mass incarceration occurred on Sharpton's and all of these folks' watch, on the post-civil rights leaders' watch. It was, and they called for the militarization of the police in order to fight drugs that was introduced in the community by the government. They called on the government to fight it, and our community has been ravaged by it ever since.
You know, Daruba, President Obama just gave a major address the other day, or just last night, in fact, to the NAACP about mass incarceration. I'm wondering if you had a chance to see that and if you had any response to that, given what you've just said. And then also, and finally, I would want you just to say a word or two to all the activists coming into the struggle now, as I started off this segment with, and to those gathering, for instance, in Cleveland at the end of this month for the Black Lives Movement Conference, and to those who have joined the Black Lives Matter Conference. What might you say to all of that? So I'm asking you, if you could, to fold into a concluding comment your response to Obama's press conference or NAACP speech about mass incarceration, and then a word of advice to those entering the movement now.
Well, briefly, the only thing I can say, unless we develop a revolutionary analysis of our situation in the United States and begin to build sovereign thinking institutions in our community, we have the resources, we have the ability to do that. Unless we're able to do this, unless we're able to sweep away all of this miscellaneous stuff and come together and do that, then we are not going to succeed. And the major impediment to that are the types of behavior, the types of practice of people and organizations like we were just discussing. We have a bogus black bourgeois leadership, a bogus leadership of gatekeepers. We have storefront militants. We have messianic leaders who lead us around in circles. What we really need to do is understand concrete organization of masses of people around concrete issues. We are not going to legislate away white supremacy. We are not going to legally sanction the culture and the system of white supremacy. They could appoint all the prosecutors, special prosecutors they want. That's not going to change the mindset of white folks who believe in the system that they created for their privilege. And so the only way we're going to deal with that is we have to develop a revolutionary approach to these. We have to build a new abolitionist movement and not a reform movement. And one of the major problems with the Black Lives Matters is that the history, their history, where they're coming from, is totally disconnected from the legacy of black radicalism and revolutionary thought in this country. And with that disconnection, they are unable to come up with and understand strategies and analyses that will really empower us. But I urge them, of course, to stay in the streets. I urge them to keep putting pressure on the black comprador class and on the system, and exercise the only real political power that we have in this country, and that's as a social, political, and cultural monkey wrench, an economic monkey wrench. We need to bring things to a halt. If we can't drive safely in the streets without being murdered by police, then the police shouldn't be able to come to our community at all without the threat of death, without the threat of sanction. That's what it should be. Our community should be able to defend themselves and defend their integrity. And there's nothing wrong with that. Every human being has the right to self-defense, except black people. We only have the right to forgive. We only have the option to beg for mercy. This is a coward's mentality. This is surrender to white supremacy and the militarization of American society. We need to understand that this is a hard struggle, and we will be characterized as haters and terrorists or whatever, but the empire, whenever we throw a brick at white supremacy in America, we also throw a brick at American empire abroad and the support of imperialism around the world.
Well, Daruba Ben Wahad, thank you very much for joining us in this segment of I Mix What I Like here at the Real News Network. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining us here at The Real News Network. And for all involved, I'm Jared Ball. And as always, like Fred Hampton used to say to you, we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. So peace. Catch you in the whirlwind, everybody.
Nosso país. país.
Silêncio.
Invadem o nosso país.
Chipenda, a convite de Savimbi, Holden e Chipenda, porque estão sendo varridos
pelas forças progressistas,
porque estão sendo varridos
pelas forças progressistas.
Os americanos
invadem o nosso país. Nosso país,
Zairense,
invadem o nosso país.
Este trio bandoleiro terá que ser julgado após a independência
no campo da revolução.
Norte-americano,
invadem o nosso país.
Sul-africano,
invadem o nosso país.
Zairense,
invadem nosso país.
Este trio bandoleiro terá que ser julgado após a independência
no campo da revolução.
Norte-americano,
invadem o nosso país.
Sul-africano,
invadem o nosso país.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was a song by the MPLA, Liberation Movement in Angola, who fought for independence against the Portuguese colonizers in the 1960s and 1970s in a liberation struggle, and that was A Vitória e Ceuta. Talks about that really is what African Americans are really doing. Like, once again, they're also fighting against colonialism. They're fighting against the capitalist system that has imposed colonialism on them, you know, and exploits them and rapes their nation for, like, resources and, like, cheap labor and all this sort of stuff. Or, like, brutalizes and kills them and this sort of thing. You know, like, the thing that kicked off the liberation struggle in Mozambique, I was doing a lot of reading on this recently. In Mozambique, what actually happened that really caused the anti-colonial struggle to really take off was the massacre of about 600 people by Portuguese government troops at a peaceful demonstration, too, in a small town in northern Mozambique. You know, these people come out to, like, you know, petition the governor, you know, for the release of certain political prisoners, and they were just gunned down. You know, and this is the kind of treatment that colonized peoples have come to expect from the colonizer. You know, from the imperialist forces in the world. This is the kind of, you know, treatment they've come to expect. You know, they understand that they will be brutalized, they will face death, they will face torture, they will face, you know, imprisonment, they will face all kinds of repercussions. But they know that they have to do this if they want to actually achieve liberation, if they want to achieve self-determination for themselves and for their people. And, you know, as a communist myself, you know, the only thing that really comes above self-determination within communism is class struggle. That's it. You know, and of course, like, you saw this in the article which I read earlier as well about, like, the African-Canadian struggle against police brutality. In that article, you know, there was a lot of talk, of course, about African Americans also being working class and them being mistreated and exploited on that basis as well. And, you know, racial apartheid just adds to that burden which they already carry as working class people. You know, they face additional marginalization on the basis of skin color. You know, and this is... But they still have that common experience of class, of being working class and being exploited by the bourgeoisie, being exploited by capitalism, being used you know, their labor being used to create profits for the elite, you know, for the ruling class that actually owns the, you know, the farms, the factories, you know, all the enterprises within the mines, all the enterprises within capitalism, you know, within society. You know, and that has to be part of the analysis. You know, that was really what Jared Ball and was really talking about in that whole, like, talk about the black radical tradition in the United States and how these movements that really were successful, like, really came out of the 1960s and really had strong leadership and clear platforms, like the Black Panther Party, whose 10-point platform I played at the beginning of the show. You know, they had a class analysis as well as a an analysis about race. You know, and they understood how these things intersected. And how you have to have, like, a very clear sort of platform. You can't just say, okay, this is all about identity politics. If we just had, like, black leaders and black capitalists and black entrepreneurs and all this sort of stuff, and everything would be fine. Black people in places of power, everything would be okay. Or if we just change people's minds, if we just had more black narratives on the TV, on the radio, and that sort of thing, that would be enough. It's all about culture. You know, these guys, the Black Panther, really say that's not enough. You know, you have to see how class plays a role in this. You have to have a systemic analysis. You have to know what you're really fighting against if you want to really affect meaningful change. This is very important to understand. So, and also how, like, your struggle fits with the struggle of other people around the world. You know, like, that's one of the reasons why I decided to play that. You know, these are Africans in Angola fighting against colonization in the 1960s and 1970s. Just like the Black Panther Party was, like, in struggle in the United States against the system of racial apartheid in the 1960s, 1970s. And back then, they understood the connection between these different movements, and they were fighting against a common enemy. And they expressed solidarity for each other, and they gave each other support, these different movements in different countries. There was there was a lot of international solidarity, which these days you don't really see in the same way. But really, that is crucial. If you want to, like, build a struggle against racial apartheid, against capitalism, against imperialism, you have to link arms. Working class people have to link arms across cultures, across societies, across borders, across the color line for that matter. You know, they have to join arms. They have to link arms, realize that they have a common struggle here, a common interest in opposing these systems of oppression and exploitation in the world that affect most everybody to some degree. You know, some more than others. You know, some people are obviously going to be more marginalized and exploited by others. But of course, in the end, if you're working class, you will be exploited. And you ultimately do have a common interest in seeing that exploitation overthrown. And it's very important to understand. So I'm going to take a short break. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
If you're looking for power, you certainly come to the right place, because you are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. 250 watts of community power.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I volunteer at CFRU because it's a space that really encourages creativity and expressing yourself.
My name is Stacy. I love discovering music that sounds good to me. All kinds of music.
I love the people, I love the atmosphere, and everyone loves radio, and you can tell.
If you love radio and would like to get involved, volunteer at CFRU. No previous experience is required, and we provide all the training. Check out our website at cfru.ca or call Christopher at 519-824-4120, extension 58341, or email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Volunteering at CFRU breeds minds, breeds culture. So come on down.
Pour les francophones et francophiles de la région, CFRU diffuse l'Eclipse, l'émission musicale française, à tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h le matin. Si vous faites partie d'une groupe ou une organisation francophone locale qui veut se faire distinguer, ou bien vous voulez contribuer à notre programme, s'il vous plaît, me contactez, Sandra Doucette, par courriel francophone@cfru.ca. Soyez à l'écoute tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h pour les annonces des événements d'actualité et bien sûr la bonne musique française.
I spy with my little eye a riddle. Find the spot where students come to show off their creative spark and walk through this great art park. To find the answer to this clue, find Bonfire, John McRae's greatest companion. Do you know the answer? Pick up an iSpy card and fill in question number 10. iSpy Guelph is a do-it-yourself scavenger hunt, drawing inspiration from the traditional iSpy game. To commemorate the 100th anniversary of In Flanders Fields, iSpy takes you on a journey of John McRae's life in Guelph. All iSpy locations are outdoors, open to Guelph residents of all ages, and wheelchair accessible. iSpy cards can be picked up at the Information Center in City Hall, at any Guelph Public Library branch, or you can print one at guelph.ca/iSpy. To get your prize, return a completed iSpy card to the Tourism Information Center located in City Hall from now until August 28th. Good luck, iSpyers!
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Now, just to kind of like what I was talking about before the break is the concept of internationalism and how important it is to join these different struggles together in like a really common sort of effort against a common enemy. In the case of like against the capitalist class, against the forces that actually support imperialism in the world, against the capitalist state, you know, in general, which of course like. You know, the capitalist class, of course, is a worldwide kind of phenomenon. I mean, like, it intervenes, like, around the world, exploits, you know, capitalism is a global force right now. And yeah, like, it affects everyone around the world. Working class people all over the globe, like, are facing the same enemy, perhaps more so than maybe ever in history. And the global economy has become so integrated. And, you know, these different movements that are emerging, they're facing a similar kind of, they're coming to similar conclusions in a lot of cases. Like, I just was talking about the African-American struggle in the United States and how there's a lot of critique now of the traditional leadership of that struggle. And it's very, very real shortcomings in addressing the, you know, things like mass incarceration, police brutality, continued racial apartheid, and like, you know, marginalization of Africans and exploitation of them by the system. You know, the traditional leadership doesn't really have an answer except like appoint more black people to, like, you know, as, you know, chief prosecutors and as like attorney generals and as like, you know, people high up in the American government. Of course, we know that doesn't work. They just become part of the system. They end up perpetuating the system. And that's no solution. And I think the example of Obama really has debunked that. And, like, of course, in other parts of the world, like we see in Greece, I talked about in last week how the Social Democratic Government of Syriza really discredited itself by caving to the demands of international creditors, which they said they wouldn't do. They basically sold out their own people. They sold out the Greek working class. And they accepted even harsher demands than were originally on the table in the negotiations that they were underway with the EU and the IMF. So it's like these betrayals of the working class. I mean, they're becoming like too big to ignore. They're just too in your face, too like all these people selling out, all these leaders selling out who claim to be champions of like working people or like marginalized people, or racialized people. And in the end, they turned out to be frauds effectively. Like they didn't do anything to really empower them. Or to really, like, empower them or change their condition in any substantial way. You know, they really ended up selling out and basically catering to the demands of the capitalist class, the bankers, the investors, the hedge fund managers, the big corporations, what have you. That's ultimately who they ended up serving. And not the working class, not the marginalized people, not African Americans, not any of these people who they originally claimed to be representing. So people really come to the conclusion that, yeah, we do need really, really radical leadership that is really based in the people. You know, there's not going to be any, like, savior who's coming down to rescue us. You know, it's we ourselves who have to enact change. And, like, that is really the case in Greece right now. There's been a lot of anger in Greece after the betrayal of about a week or so ago when Syriza did sell out to the to the banking establishment, to the EU, and the demands of the IMF. And there's been a lot of protests. There's been a lot of people having to leave Syriza. You know, left-wing progressives leaving Syriza because they just can't, in all good conscience, stay there. In some cases, they've been driven out. And the KKE, the Greek Communist Party, is really the only force in Greece right now that is really taking a stand against austerity in a very meaningful way. And it's been active. It's been organizing trade unions. It's been, like, really in the streets and being a major force right now. And, you know, and of course, unlike Syriza, it's a party that's really based, rooted in the working class, in the working class struggle against capitalism. Came out of that. And it's still rooted in these working class communities there. You know, so it's in moments like this the working class really realizes who its friends really are. You know, now one of the things which, of course, and one which really drives home the fact that we're these different movements in different countries are really facing a common enemy is what's really not talked about so much with the Greek crisis. I mean, what gets talked about is the role of the EU and sometimes the IMF, but the role of the United States and the American monetary system and like the and American finance capital in the Greek crisis is not often talked about. So I really want to kind of get into that. I'm going to play a clip about that right now. This is also from the Real News Network, Mark Weisbrot, talking about this issue, about how the United States and American capitalism played a major role in, you could say, imposing austerity on the Greek people. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
What's up, world, and welcome back to the Real News Network. I'm Jared Ball here in Baltimore. As the struggle in Greece continues, with much of the media focus being decisions taken by Greek and European political and economic leaders, one question we wanted to pay particular attention to here is the involvement in this crisis of the United States. In other words, what role is taken previously and now by this country, and what is the impact on the Greek economic crisis of the U.S. specifically? To address this question and joining us now is Mark Weisbrot, who, among other things, is an economist and columnist and co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to the Real News Network, Mark Weisbrot.
Thanks, Jared. Good to be with you.
So as I said in the intro, what, from your perspective, is the impact of the United States and its dominated institutions on this crisis in Greece?
Well, the U.S. government, the Obama administration, its main concern is really they don't want to see Greece leave the Eurozone. And they're looking at it kind of from an empire point of view, that if Greece leaves the Eurozone could be weaker, it could disintegrate, the whole process could weaken European unity. In worst case scenarios, Greece could leave NATO, Greece could end up borrowing from Russia. So these are the way, this is the way it's looking at it. And that puts them a little differently from Europe. Europe is a little more divided on, they don't want Greece to leave the Eurozone either. They want to get, their strategy is really to get rid of the current Greek government, the Syriza government, and force them out. And the U.S. is okay with that, but they're more worried about them forcing them possibly out of the Eurozone altogether. So one place where this shows up is through the IMF, because the U.S. dominates the IMF. Now, they don't usually use all their muscle at the IMF to go against Europe. They would normally let the Europeans decide what happens in Europe. But in this case, there was a board meeting before the referendum in Greece on July 5th, where the U.S. Got the IMF board against the wishes of Germany, especially, to release a study that the IMF had done showing that Greece's debt was not sustainable and that there had to be debt relief. And that really angered the Germans and their allies, because this kind of helped Syriza in the referendum on July 5th, because Syriza, the government, which was pushing for a no vote to reject the last offer that the European authorities had given them, the government was able to cite that study and say, look, we need debt relief. This is an unsustainable debt, vote no. And so that was a real point of friction between the U.S. and Germany. And there's a case where the U.S. used its muscle in the IMF to get that report released before the referendum, and it could have had an influence. Now, the problem is that this doesn't really do Greece or the world any good, because it's nice that they want debt relief, but the IMF is still signed on to a program in Greece that will not allow the economy to recover, and the debt relief isn't going to help that at all.
So if I heard you correctly, the United States hasn't had a particular problem with what led to this crisis. Their problem comes with the various forms that a response to this crisis have taken among the Greek people, which is somewhat related to the second question I wanted to ask you about this looking somewhat to some of us like a macrocosmic version of the predatory lending we saw here. That, of course, the United States as a whole didn't have a problem with for individuals in the United States. Does that analogy work at all for you? And if not, please tell us why.
Well, I don't think it's really analogous to predatory lending, because this isn't really about the money. It's not about how much Greece is going to pay on its debt, which is unsustainable, and how much the European governments are going to lose, and it's you know, probably 86% government-owned debt now, because they've already bailed out the private lenders. So it's really about power, and using that power on behalf of the European authorities, using that power to change Greece and change Europe into societies that have a smaller social safety net, reduced pensions, healthcare spending, weaker labor movements, more inequality. More like the United States, actually. That's the kind of transformation they're trying to make in Europe. And they've been using the debt crisis and associated vulnerabilities of the more vulnerable European countries to force those changes there, not only Greece, but Portugal, Spain, Ireland, Italy, and even in the whole Eurozone as a whole. That is their vision. That's what they are trying to do.
But at least for some of us, that is in some way how we interpreted the predatory lending impact or purpose or function here in the United States, to do just what you said is the intent among, you know, by the United States for those in Greece, that is to weaken the resistance to a drawback of society safety nets and other benefits to working people. But you don't see that as having the same function here?
Well, if you look at the response to the financial crisis and the Great Recession here, it was very different than in Europe. Now, it's true, if you look at the state level, you did see some of that. You had, you know, cutbacks, teachers and other state employees laid off, and things that were probably also politically motivated. But at the federal level, you had a stimulus. It wasn't enough of a stimulus, but if you look at they didn't attempt to use the Great Recession as an excuse for imposing nationwide austerity and taking away. We don't have anywhere near as much to take away as Europe, but they didn't cut Medicare or Social Security or do any of the kind of things that you see in Europe. And we didn't have the prolonged recession either that they had in Europe. You know, unemployment in Europe is twice the level of the United States, and that's primarily because of the different response of macroeconomic policy here as compared to Europe. I'm not going to defend it, because they could have done much more. We're still down 3 or 4 million jobs from where we should be right now. So they should have done a lot more, and it would have been easy to do a lot more. But compared to Europe, it was still very, very different.
Mark Weisbrot, thank you again for joining us here at the Real News Network.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us as well here at the Real News Network. And for all involved, I'm Jared Ball. And as always, as Fred Hampton used to say to you, we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. So peace, everybody. Catch you in the whirlwind.
Even sold those execs, hold the checks. They sold us the shit, now we're sick to death. It's a slow-mo bomb, don't hit the deck. The frogs don't know how to pose a threat. Sitting still like the pose in the sofa set. Got the kids on meds and moms off the breast. Stress cracks in the crust, they pass the buck. The corrupt from the past to the future truck. The hugest chunks of poop, fruits, and junk. Pump that shit for the mass consumption. Production, taking a massive dump. Then the whole world's flat from capital lust. And trust that they fuck with the stats and stuff. They lie from the side to the back to front. I said, holy shit, just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, growth protect the gross and the net. Just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, I said, holy shit, and just how big are we supposed to get? Growth protect the gross and the net, and yet, yeah. You need to grow for the rest to waste. It's so fast, no chance it will slow the pace. There's no way, say masters of market fate. Backslide might cause a collapse as they pass the plate. They're ticking like the Catholic faith, cap and trade. You know the growth gon' get paid. And how long do we gon' reach the phase of when each man faced with the same starvation? And ignorance ain't bliss, it's complacence. Work on this shit, grins on our faces. Every last drop rot from nations. Boys under work, you stand an ovation for it. Ha, I said, holy shit, just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, growth protect the gross and the net. Just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, ha, I said, holy shit, and just how big are we supposed to get? Growth protect the gross and the net. And yet, yeah. They need the growth to protect their asses. Cause the lack of the growth and the market crashes. Splash, the text and the news they flash. The masses are stressed by a mass collapse. Yeah, they measure growth in the trees they slash. The hills that they blast from mining shafts. And like the bombs dropped on Iraq, they got contracts for jets, boats and gats. And they measure growth in the oldest math. They add and they add and they don't subtract. No tax when they take and they rape and slash. They raking all the coals with the souls they get. Yeah, growth poses pro bowler cap. Throws its weight all over the map. And a lot of profit from aftermath. They got them counting the stacks off or collapse. Yeah, I said, holy shit, it's just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, growth protect the gross and the net. Just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, I said, holy shit, and just how big are we supposed to get? Growth protect the gross and the net. And yet, we're living too large. I said, we're living too large. We're living too large. I say we're living too large. Lord.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That, of course, was Lee Reed with The Growth. And, you know, we just heard from Mark Weisbrot at the on the Real News Network talking about what the role of the United States is in the Greek crisis. You know, and of course, these strategic calculations, like trying to prevent the United States from leaving, trying to prevent Greece from leaving the Eurozone or NATO or all these different kind of things, you know, that really is the strategy of an imperialist power, right? They're seeing this really in terms of, like, how can they keep basically their empire intact, right? Prevent certain elements from breaking away or defecting or, like, going into a rival power block and this sort of thing, you know, and this is kind of the calculus that goes on in Washington. But what I find is much more interesting, it actually, like, is the protests that are going on right now actually in Greece against austerity and against the kind of the deal which the government of Greece has entered into. and Dimitri Lascaris, who is a London-based lawyer who is also like quite progressive, engaged in progressive activism, and is not actually in Greece. He actually got a chance to interview quite a few of these the demonstrators who actually were out in the streets against this, you know, against the austerity measures being passed and against this kind of surrender by the Greek government to the EU and the IMF and the demands basically of the bankers and the investors and the capitalist, the international capitalist class in general, you know. And it's very interesting what he found. So, like, I'm gonna play that these interviews for you right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
We're here in front of the Greek Parliament, where a very large crowd is gathering in anticipation of a second vote on the prior actions required by the creditors of Greece, pursuant to the July 13th agreement with Greece's creditors. We've been trying to get people to come on the, go on the record and speak to us about why they're out here, and we're being met with a wall of silence. And I just asked somebody off the record why people are so reluctant here to speak to the to a journalist, and they brought to my attention a Greek saying, one that was figured very prominently during the protest that led up to the Oki vote in the July 5th referendum. I'm not going to repeat it because it was full of expletives, but basically what she told me is the journalists in this country have lost all respect of the populace, and the protesters simply have no interest in speaking to them, which is unfortunate, but I think is really telling in terms of the quite negative role that the media in this country have played in the crisis and the descent of Greece into the current quagmire. And we wanted to talk to people, the young people here who came out tonight, because 80% of Greece's youth, a very, very high percentage of the youth of Greece, voted Oki in the July 5th referendum. And we're wondering if you could explain to us what motivated so many young people of Greece to say no to the ultimatum that was put to Greece by the Troika?
I think they wanted change, and for since a long time, since the Greece joined the EU, they've always been under pressure and haven't always benefited the best things as opposed to France and other countries, and they wanted change. And as now is Greece is in a heavy recession, they want to get out of the EU so that they can continue with their own economy, and because ultimately the euro isn't a very good currency for them.
And I just think that the young people in Greece don't find anything compelling in the European Union for their life and their jobs and their money, and they just think that being alone is better.
It's been a choice. If you had to choose between the terms that Prime Minister Tsipras agreed to on July 13th and leaving the Eurozone, if you had to make that choice, what would you choose?
I'd leave the Eurozone.
Yeah, me too.
And you don't have any real concerns about what the consequences of that would be for the Greek economy?
On the short term, it won't be very good, but on the longer term, it will be much more beneficial than if you'd stay with the EU.
Is that a view you share?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You know, during the Oki vote, the referendum, the leaders of Europe, they said repeatedly that if the Greek people voted Oki, that meant that Greece would have to leave the Eurozone.
61%
yes,
voted Oki.
That's right. So, and they said that if they voted Oki, they would have to leave the Eurozone. If you had to choose between leaving the Eurozone and the austerity that the Prime Minister has agreed to, what would you choose?
Of course, leaving the Eurozone. We don't.
You would leave.
Yes.
And you, sir?
Yes. We want to leave the fucking Eurozone. Okay?
Yeah.
We don't want any more Eurozone.
And what do you think would happen if Greece left the Eurozone?
They have to have a second plan, a plan B, because a plan B exists, but they are not willing to announce this plan B to the people.
And why do you think they're not willing?
Because they are part of the system. And they said to us fucking lies. Mm-hmm. in order to vote them.
And do you agree that they misled the Greek people?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Definitely.
Do you think that that's true of all the MPs in Syriza? Do you think the people on the left wing of Syriza, that they also lied? Or do you think that they are...
We can't trust no one anymore. This deal is... for us, it's a blackmail. It's going to bring us back very many years. And it's not good for us. We have a lot of measures of economy that is going to destroy our economy. It's not going to be a progress, you know, to our debt. Our debt is going to be up. Mm-hmm. Our GDP is going to be more lower. So our debt is going to be more growing.
Do you think that the government has explained to the people what this new deal means? Do you think they've done a good job?
The government has betrayed the Greek people, because when we have the I don't know the word about the, sorry.
The referendum?
The referendum. Mm-hmm. All the people said no to this agreement. And then the government go and it was like we vote yes.
So if you had to choose between the two, you would choose leaving the Eurozone?
Yes, yes, yes. But leaving the Eurozone without an agreement.
Yes, I understand.
Because if I leave Eurozone with an agreement for the debt, then I will have more worse things than this. I have to explain to my loaners that the money in Greece was spent not only for the people, was spent only in corruption, it was spent for companies, for money, it's all of this.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.
I'm Anastasia from Greece.
And I'm Benny Kuchina from Germany.
Because we don't believe in austerity measures. I mean, we've done this for 5 years and it's pointless. More austerity will bring more austerity, and that's why we're here, to protest against the new austerity measures that we're going to be voted today.
I think the austerity is not the solution, so it makes worse and worse and worse, and the most people in Greece just suffer because of the politics. So.
In the days before the referendum, Chancellor Merkel and François Hollande, Jean-Claude Juncker, they all said that if Greece voted no, they would have to leave the Eurozone. If you were put to that choice, what would you choose? If you had to choose the austerity regime that Prime Minister Tsipras has agreed to or leaving the Eurozone, what would you choose?
I think I would choose to leave the EU, to have a Brexit, because with the politics of Germany is imperialistic for me. And yes, I think the European Union must be updated. Now I think it's shit.
I think that this European Union has a huge democracy deficiency. So if it was in my personal choice, I would have chose to leave Eurozone. But at this point, this is why there was a coup. This was the World Trade hashtag. Because this government was put at the gunpoint to vote for these austerity measures, to stay in Eurozone, because at this particular moment, our banks were closed, we were out of money, and we couldn't do that. It would be the plan B, but it would be like either you shoot yourself, you kill yourself, or we're going to kill you.
So we've now had an opportunity to speak, or at least attempt to speak, to a number of protesters. Behind us, there's a gathering of organized labor, and they're talking about the destruction of the rights of organized labor under this new agreement. What organized labor has suffered up until now under the prior bailouts. There's a really an interesting mixture of people here. One group of people was very reluctant to talk to us. Those were predominantly anarchists. Apparently they have a very low opinion of journalists, as we discovered. Others were much more willing to speak out. And together they're all bound up in one purpose, and that is to put a stop to what they view as the destruction of Greek society and the strangulation of the Greek economy.
I saw a newspaper picture
from the political campaign. A woman was kissing a child who was obviously in pain. She spills with compassion. Is that young child's face in her hands she grips? Can you imagine all that greed and avarice coming down on that child's lips? Well, I hope I don't die too soon. I prayed a lot, my soul to say, yes, I'll be a good boy. I'm trying so hard to behave, because there's one thing I know, I'd like to live long enough to savor. That's when it finally puts you in the ground. I'll stand on your grave and tramp the dirt down. When England was the horror of the world, Margaret was her madam. And the future looked as bright and as clear as the black tarmac Adam. Well, I hope that she sleeps well at night, isn't haunted by every tiny detail. When she held that lovely face in her hands, all she thought of was betrayal. And now the cynical ones say that it all ends the same in the long run. Try telling that to the desperate father who just squeezed the life from his only son. And how his only voice is in your head and dreams you've never dreamt. Try telling him the subtle difference between justice and contempt. Try telling me she isn't angry with this pitiful discontent. When they flaunt it in your face as you line up for punishment, and then expect you to say thank you, straighten up, proud and pleased, because you've only got the symptoms, you haven't got the whole disease. Just like a schoolboy whose head's like a tin can, filled up with dreams, then parked down the drain. Try telling that to the boys on both sides, being blown to bits. I'll be going before we fold our arms and start to weep. I never thought for a moment that human life could be so cheap. But when stay.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That, of course, was Elvis Costello with Tramp the Dirt Down, an anti-austerity song which he did in the 1980s, specifically directed against the Thatcher government in the UK, but could just as easily be applied to any other sort of leadership, which, of course, has beaten the working class down and really oppressed them. And, you know, it kind of... You know, to people in Syriza and certainly in the EU and the IMF and these people who are negotiating these kind of trade deals and bailouts and all this kind of stuff, you know, people's lives just seem like numbers to them. You know, that's what it seems like. You know, they don't actually see what people are actually going through on the ground. You know, and of course they have diametrically opposing interests to the people on the ground. You know, working people are trying to survive. People are trying to, like, live. And these people are trying to make a profit. You know, these fat cats trying to make a profit. You know, they have the opposite interests, you know, and they don't care about the working people and what they're going through. You know, like the guy who, you know, working class father who might have to, like, you know, give up his house or give up his home or not have a place to live, you know, for himself and his kids, you know, if these austerity measures go through, and, like, if he loses access to social services and, like, loses any, you know, subsidies for housing or loses his job or, like, has his income slashed or what have you, you know, that it could be the it literally could be between life and death for them. So this is, like, pretty much what we mean by saying, like, you know, that the capitalist and the proletarian have, like, diametrically opposed interests in society, and they're irreconcilable when it comes right down to it. Ultimately, one class has to win out. Ultimately, there has to be revolution. Class struggle only ends when one has emerged victorious. When the working classes emerge victorious and torn down capitalism, there can be only one. And the working class, you know, which of course is the vast majority of the human race, for there to be justice in this world, the working class has to prevail in that struggle against those who exploit in the name of profit. That's really what it comes down to. So I'm going to really sign off on that. On that note, here on Back in the USSR, we'll be back next week. But just, I really want to emphasize once again just how these struggles, these working class struggles around the world, and it doesn't matter what color skin you have or what nation you're in, ultimately you're up against the same enemy in the capitalist class. You know, working people around the world need to join hands, link arms, fight against racism, fight against all those things that are used to try to divide us, keep us from working together, and really join hands and really shake the system to its foundations and ultimately tear it down, build a new system which has our interests, has human need at its core. That's really what we need to do. So on that note, solidarity, everyone. And like Jared Ball says, you know, catch you in the whirlwind. Peace if you're willing to fight for it, as Fred Hampton says. Solidarity.
Hi, my name is Kevin, and back in the 80s I used to hang around CFRU all the time. Anyone can volunteer here. Just email volunteer@cfru.ca or visit cfru.ca for more information.
Looking for used furniture or other odds and ends? The Guelph Food Bank is holding its annual summer series of fundraising garage sales, barbecues, and silent auctions starting Friday and Saturday, May 1st and 2nd. This is a great way to get a great deal and support a vital community network. The series takes place most Fridays and Saturdays over the summer from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 100 Crimea Street in Guelph. This is a physically accessible location. For the full schedule, check out guelphfoodbank.ca under Volunteers and Support.
Aerobics. Gonna stretch your mind.
Your life.
Tuesday morning.
Your life.
7 to 9. CFRU 93.3.
The 32nd Annual Hillside Festival takes place July 24th, 25th, and 26th at Guelph Lake, rain or shine, featuring performances by Astral Swans, Bad Bad Not Good, Badminton Racket, Baskery, Battle of Santiago, Braids, The Brothers Landreth, Bulgarian Voices Trio, By Divine Right, Tim Chasen, Nels Klein Singers, Constantines, Nick Crane, Alex Cuba, Daka Braka, Del Bell, Daldrums, Echo Deck, Darren Edens, Eloquent, Etiquette, Everlovin' Jug Band, Nick Ferrio, Jeremy Fisher, Crazy Four, David Franci, Michael Franti and Spearhead, Galacticats, The Good Lovelies, Great Lakes Swimmers, Ash Grunwald, Alana Gurr and The Great Estate, Hungai, The Henrys, Suzanne Jarvie, Mo Kenny, The Cramdens, Daniel Lanois, Last X, Lee Reed, Lids, Look Vibrant, Lulu, Minotaurs, Moonface, The Once, Nancy Pants, Doug Paisley, Fred Penner, Perch Creek, Poor Man's Whiskey, Natalie Prass, The Spring Standard, Jamie Stone's Lomax Project, Sultans of String, Tommy Crest, Team, Thus Owl, Tribecistan, Riley Walker, The Weather Station, Jason Wilson and Pee Wee Ellis, and more to be announced. For more information about purchasing tickets to this accessible event, please visit hillsidefestival.ca.
Deux grandes traditions qui malheureusement ont marqué trop d'années de l'histoire de la province de Québec. Premièrement, le mépris le plus complet pour l'intelligence du citoyen qu'on considère comme une simple marchandise électorale. Et deuxièmement, la servilité d'un parti de rois nègres qui sont en fait les valets de chambre de certains gros intérêts, surtout les plus rapaces, qui eux aussi méprisent la population comme une espèce de tribu arriérée qui est faite pour être exploitée à loisir.
Autour maintenant du chef du Parti libéral du Québec, M. Jean Charest.
Merci mon pitre. Je suis prêt. L'équipe libérale est prête. Nous sommes prêts.
Prêt, prêt, la charrue, charrée, acharnée, char, tout en char, puis la charpente de la maison qu'on a mis 40 ans à bâtir.
Un spot que militer pour Amir Kadir. Maintenant la table est mise pour 4 ans à partir. À parler à vue de Yahuri à la vue. De la bande d'abrutis qui brade abrite d'abattus. Qui vendent à rabais par la bande. Que pas de prix, une bonne mande. Fini de payer sans d'un abatti. Coupe sombre, coupe à blanc, coupe gré.
Alouette, je t'ai plus marré.
Et puis pour couper coro coro populaire, bah t'as profité d'ouf, la foule est légifère, à tombeau ouvert, puis tout sourire, ça la soupe populaire.
C'est ça être solidaire quand on a sacré tout à terre.
Afin de faire taire, un argumentaire, une écantaire, l'Amérique fait son affaire, ça fait bien trop l'affaire, des régents d'affaires, du Canada puis du conseil du patronat. Baillon, bah baillon, je raille pareil, le patron des patrons.
Ta gueule, taillon.
C'est le démat, démat, tellement, t'excite tellement que c'est comme de la musique à tes oreilles. Comment t'aimes le tête à mort des barbares, dans tes tympans d'avoir à gare.
Face à la menace de la patrie, on brandit le poing de la patrie à la face des bandits. Face à la menace de la patrie, on brandit le poing.
Libérez-nous des libéraux.
Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux.
J'te dis carré catégorique, j'en chaurais. Mike Harris,
même combat.
Même charisme, même carnesse, des biens et services publics en lice. Faut que ça finisse la chasse au BS, pour eux c'est une business. Inespéré, pis ceux qui dépérissent, il reste plus qu'à prier.
Saint-Jean-Baptiste,
ça prendra ma race
de séparatistes.
Y'a pas de place, on peut pas faire la pièce. Contrat de performance pour la SGF, pour les
CPE, pour les SDF.
Hey, un impôt sur la quête.
Ça serait pas bête.
Ça dirige le Québec comme une PME, comme un PIM, c'est put pour que la ligne les pays PES. Si ça c'est, ça se connaît, la clé du succès pour le 24 du sexe, c'est d'asexuer le Québec. Quel beau sujet pour Jean-Claude Labrec, à hauteur de gnome,
hauteur de braguette.
Sucer debout, c'est ça, se tenir drette.
Je suis prêt.
On est loin de maître chez nous. Maintenant comme jamais, y'a un traître chez nous. Ça s'entend quand il parle comme un derrière de boîte de céréales. Si tu penses me faire taire, tu fais à ton âge d'intarissable. Je vais sous ton ciel, musée, je suis ton féal.
Face à la menace de la patrie, on brandit le poing de la patrie à la face des bandits. Face à la menace de la patrie, on brandit le poing.
Libérez-nous des libéraux.
Libérez-nous des libéraux.
Libéral, fédéral, ça bringue dingue. Viva Canada, banana de Bobica.
franco, c'est plus trop juste sur tous les tableaux. C'est l'homme des chalamets et des salamalecs.
Mais comment croyez-vous qu'ils conçoivent le Québec?
Depuis 10 ans, véritable sous-marin, soit disant nous dans la même matelas, nous dématés, embarquant le gros paquebot des fédéraux dans nos